Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
The best solutions often come naturally, even for a better night's sleep. Papa and Barclay, the number one cannabis wellness company in California, just launched the Sleep Relief Collection, a powerful balance of CBD for relaxation, THC for comfort, and CBN for sedative effects. Personalize your bedtime ritual with a fast-acting tincture, precisely measured capsules, blackberry elderberry gummies, or decadent chocolate. Sleep better, naturally. Get 20% off Sleep Relief products with promo code SLEEP at papasleeps.com. That's papasleeps.com, promo code SLEEP.
Hey guys, have you tried Poshmark? Poshmark is the easiest way to buy and sell your clothes. Find your favorite brands like Nike, Lululemon, and Reformation at up to 70% off. Download the app and use Podcast10 at sign up for $10 off your first purchase. Have clothes that aren't sparking joy? Poshmark is great for selling too. Stars like Serena Williams, DJ Khaled, and more have closets on Poshmark. Just take a photo, set your price, and earn cash. It's that simple. Don't forget to use Podcast10 when you sign up for $10 off your first purchase on Poshmark.
We called ourselves the New Yardbirds for that. After that, it was Led Zeppelin.
He used to walk into the room, my father. He used to walk in the room and say whether it was good or not, what I was playing, or show me something and say, OK, you know, keep trying at that.
And Peter had this great idea, no publicity, keep people away. It's like being employed as a PR to keep the press away.
Hello and welcome to The Rock Podcast. We have a very special guest and an exclusive, but first let me introduce Anita Gevinson.
Hi. Hi, Danny. How you doing?
So instead of my talking about who we have on, since you know him, why don't you do that part?
Yes, I do know this guy. Our special guest today, CM Cushions, we call him Chad. I met Chad 12 years ago, I believe, when he interviewed me for the book he wrote about Warren Zevon. And unlike a lot of people that think they can write or think they have your best interests at heart, I've been misquoted and misunderstood many times, but that was not the case. He did such a great job that we became friends. And then he let me know he was writing this book about John Bonham. And I'm like, wow, we're doing a podcast. So here we are. And I got to tell you, Chad, the book is great. I can safely say, as a person who thought they knew a substantial amount about Led Zeppelin, I was amazed at the amount of research and the amount of things that I uncovered. And it's a really great Led Zepp 101 for anybody out there that wants to know about anything about this band, and specifically the life of the complicated, amazing genius John Bonham. So congratulations.
Well, thank you, Anita. That was a really beautiful intro, and thank you for all of your kind words. I feel very lucky that we did stay in touch and stayed friends after I had so much fun interviewing you. And I'm really appreciative for the feedback on this book. I started it pretty quickly after handing in the first draft of Warren's biography, and it had its own challenges, but this one took, I think, it took about 3 years to put this one together, but I had an inkling that Zeppelin, in some capacity, might be the next topic. I'm so glad that everybody that, you know, on your show has liked it, who's read it so far. That means a lot.
So before we start, let's just remind people that this is the news that we all heard back in 1980.
The drummer was found dead in bed yesterday after a night of heavy drinking and hard rehearsal. An autopsy is set for today, but police feel that John Bonham may have died by choking to death after vomiting in his sleep. The first major Led Zeppelin tour in 3 years had been set to begin in just a couple of weeks, but it appears to have been canceled now. And there is a question as to what Bonham's death will mean to the group. British DJ Nicky Horn.
So many tragedies have befallen this band that I really think that this is the final. It must be the end.
But the record company will not speculate on the fate of the group.
So let me ask you, how did you decide to do a book on John Bonham?
Well, I would like to ask you the same question as well. I'm curious myself about your book. I'm a huge Zeppelin fan. I'm a tremendous Zeppelin fan, and I don't play favorites because you can't have a band like Zeppelin without the major contributions of all four members. I'm a huge fan of Plant solo work, Jimmy Page, John Paul Jones, all of them. But Bonham, to me, when I first heard Led Zeppelin's music, the drums hit me in a very visceral way, and I became a huge fan based on the sound of the drums, his playing, and how it was recorded and produced. And I wanted to kind of take on the challenge of writing about a member of an entire ensemble. Bonham has been spoken about and has appeared on so many different lists for rock drummers. He's usually at the top of it, but he's a personal hero of mine. It was an opportunity to tell the Zeppelin story from a perspective that doesn't get enough focus, I think, and that would be John's perspective, John's point of view.
When you're doing a book like this, where do you start?
I was lucky that with this one, I was able to put out feelers for who I would be able to speak with. I started gathering materials just for fun, reading about Zeppelin's history for fun, while I was finishing up the first draft of Warren's book. So my starting point was to read as many books as I could get my hands on that were readily available while I was still finishing another project, and really going back to archived reviews of their of Zeppelin's original concerts and original albums, because now there's so much material that looks back on them retrospectively, which is still valuable, obviously. But when you see how the band was perceived in real time, go through the chronology of their original shows, the original tour, and if you go back and you look at the articles and how they were being perceived at the time, it tells you so much. I had a great time starting by reading about what the public and what critics thought of John Bonham before anybody knew he was going to become the legend that he is now. So the starting point was to kind of go in chronological order, reading materials as they were published, and to try and follow a narrative without knowing that they were going to become the legends that they are now, in particular him.
Do you know how many interviews you did?
It came to, I have to double check, but I think it came to about 20, something like that.
And is there some people that you didn't get that you wanted?
I'll be honest, of course. The first person that I approached, and I know I'm going to be asked about this, the very first person that I wanted to get is Jason Bonham. He's an amazing drummer, amazing musician. I love the bands he's in now. So that was the first person that I contacted. Jason's management had said that he wished me best of luck and to keep his dad's legacy alive, but he didn't want to go on the record, unfortunately.
He used to walk into the room, my father, he used to walk in the room and say whether it was good or not, what I was playing, or show me something and say, okay, you know, keep trying at that. But he never actually sat down in rudiments and all this stuff. He just, like, came in and said, you know, if you can make a 4-4 straight rhythm sound exciting, then anything you throw in afterwards is going to be good.
It would have been great to talk with the band members themselves. Robert Plant, at one point, I was told, was on the fence, 50-50, that I might have been able to obtain him. But it wasn't just a Zeppelin story. So when I got disappointed about that, I wanted to speak with musicians that knew him prior. And so I was able to get a lot of my focus there. Guys that had played with him, jammed with him before Zeppelin was even an entity. And that ended up being very valuable because John's story starts, you know, quite in advance of 1969. And that's what I think hadn't been covered enough.
Let's speak to now Mr. John Bonham, who's drums, timpani, and backing vocal. Hello, John.
Hello.
So glad you can make it along. What sort of things were you doing before Led Zeppelin was formed?
Nothing, really. I just played with Tim Rose for about 2 months before joining Led Zeppelin. But before that, nothing sort of worth mentioning.
Tim Rose was where he got scouted. He was playing that gig for a couple of months and was at a Tim Rose performance when Jimmy Page actually showed up with Peter Grant to kind of scout him for, you know, soon to be called Led Zeppelin. They were still the New Yardbirds. But Bonham had an affinity for the drums since he was a child, largely self-taught and also an amazing listener. Many of his biggest heroes as a kid were big band drummers and jazz drummers, which I thought was fantastic because I'm a big jazz buff myself. I play piano, but jazz music is a big thing to me.
Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich, right?
Those are the two big ones. You got it. And it's funny because that interest did stay with him. Over the years, I was told that he would, you know, pay attention to, you know, what people like Billy Cobham and Tony Williams were up to in the late 60s and 70s, you know, where jazz drumming evolved too. So I think John always had a huge fascination and an appreciation for jazz percussion. It never went away. But he did play with his first bands starting when he was still a teenager. The Blue Star Trio was one of the earliest ones. It came to about a dozen before the New Yardbirds became his full-time job. But largely self-taught. He did have a couple of mentors as a kid, and one of them was a gentleman I got to speak with named Gary Alcott, who's still in Birmingham. He's a jazz drummer still, in his 70s, still touring. So he knew John when John was about 16, 17 years old, and taught him some things. Paradiddles and some of the earliest stuff.
So he did the construction job, though, his father.
Yeah.
But and he worked as a laborer while mm-hmm. he was playing in bands for a pretty long time. I mean, he was 16 and he was still working construction, and there was a part of him that actually liked that because he was making a living. And then he hadn't met his wife yet, but then he soon met
Pat yet. Yeah.
Then he soon meets Pat, and then he's got a child, and now he's got to keep working. But he wasn't one of those guys that refused to do any job that wasn't music.
The thing that's interesting is that the guys from Zeppelin, I think this might apply to perhaps all four of them, in particular, Page and Plant. They loved real blues musicians, the real early stuff, Robert Johnson, real Delta blues. They were huge aficionados of that. Now, that music, of course, comes out of poverty and traveling musicians to go where the work would take you. But the thing that's interesting about all the members of Zeppelin is that they weren't particularly poverty-stricken when they were kids themselves. They came from middle class or not completely well-off, but comfortable upbringings as kids. They just loved the music. And Bonham's grandfather had founded this very successful construction company in Birmingham that had lasted a few generations already. And it was kind of an unspoken thing that John would probably take it over at some point. He had a younger brother, Mick, and they both worked on those construction sites. Their first job was helping Dad. I think the camaraderie of working together, because it was a family business, and working with Dad, and John actually had a certain amount of skill with it, would use some of those skill sets from the construction site when he would build speaker cabinets and do modifications to his drum sets. And before his passing, not that far in advance of his passing, he actually had started to bring back the construction business. When Zeppelin was not touring during those gaps, they brought back their father's business and started to rebuild homes. I think there was some serious sense of normalcy in being part of a family business with his brother and with his father. And there was a comfort level of always being home when he could. Of the four members, John Paul Jones, I think, would be happy staying at home as well. But Bonham was not a fan of touring. And I think in many ways, his first job in the construction business, working with Dad, working with his brother, I think that had a sense of home to him, because he would dip back into it his whole life.
Reading through the book, and I'm thinking to myself, man, why didn't anybody plan it better? And then I started realizing there was no blueprint for this. They were doing this stuff, the touring and the writing and the recording, and they were making it up. They were inventing it is what they were doing. But even having said that, their managers, they were, well, especially Peter Grant. I mean, I know there were some pros to what he did mm-hmm. and what he wouldn't allow. And if you want to go over some of those odd things, I know that they wouldn't do this Ed Sullivan show, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, television was off the list for the most part. Yeah, they wanted people to have to go see them in person.
Okay. In hindsight, worked out, but, you know, what? And no singles. Could not release singles, right?
Mm-hmm. There's so much included in what your overall observation is with that, Anita. That's true. They were trailblazers in so many ways. have to remember the Beatles, and you had brought this up in conversation, you and I talked about this. The Beatles, you know, they did Shay, and they stopped touring because they couldn't hear their own instruments, and then they inadvertently became these incredible self-producers and innovators in the studio because it was just it was their preference over having the screaming crowd. And the Rolling Stones had played a couple of tremendous venues already, but Led Zeppelin, because of the demand that they mandated, because they weren't on television, because their film, The Song Remains the Same, wasn't released until many years later, and because there weren't singles, the idea of the concept album, which people gravitated towards a full LP, with Zeppelin, every album became a concept album because you had to have the LP. So you had to take it as one great, you know, cohesive unit, which was brilliant that the marketing dictated you accept the full album. And because you had to go see them in person, they inadvertently really were the first major band that you could consider arena rock. Nobody had the same amount. I mean, there was Cream, The Who. There were huge bands. There were the Stones. But Zeppelin's strategy, especially Jimmy Page and Peter Grant, the way that they had constructed full ownership and the marketing strategy behind the artistry, it was both. You know, it's not to take anything away from the music. They're artists. But the marketing that they had, it was unprecedented, and there was no blueprint for the type of fame and what they got away with.
You're absolutely right about the publicity thing, because I've talked to Bill Harry. I don't know if you know who he is. Okay. And Bill, just so you know, he came out of the Mercy Beat area. He knew the Beatles, and he was just connected with everybody. So when Peter Graham was looking for a PR guy, Bill Harry had already moved to London, and but he told me, he said, you know, I can't believe it. They hired me to be the publicist to keep the press away.
Peter Grant wanted me to take over the publicity for his band, which he called at the time the New Yardbirds. And Peter had this great idea, no publicity, keep people away. It's like being employed as a PR to keep the press away, which created this amazing sort of image.
That's an awesome point. Yeah, that's...
But let me ask you something else I wanted to clarify.
I love your opinion.
What is it about the Midlands, Birmingham, that area? I talked to Glenn Hughes, and he said, you know, it's like the hard rock capital of the world, all the people that came out of there.
You know, and once again, this is... You know, Robert and I and John and Ozzy and Tony Iommi and Geezer and Rob Halford were all born in this part of the world. For all intents and purposes, it's the birthplace of hard rock in the UK. Black Country Woman, sure. Black Country Communion, it's a thread if you want. You know, we're not taking from Zep. We love Zep. We're part of Zep in the family with Jason in the band. We're all really joined at the hip.
They're all from that area. There's a huge music culture that takes place there, and I think part of it, this was summed up, one of the most entertaining interviews that I had gotten was with a man named Jim Simpson. And Jim Simpson owns a blues and rock club in the Midlands currently, and is a musician. He was with Locomotive, one of the early bands that Bonham was in, and he is a music producer as well. So he produced John before Zeppelin was a thing. And then Jim was also one of the earliest managers for Black Sabbath before they took off. And I got to speak with Jim, who's a really cool, funny, fascinating dude, who's also a huge jazz fan as well, and a jazz musician. He's a trumpeter. But the way that he had described it when we were talking is that there you have very few options if you are from that area. The Midlands in general, Birmingham or Brum, as it's referred to, is a very big industrial city, but it also has a bustling music culture. So you have these two things. If you're interested in not spending the rest of your life in some form of manual labor, well, I don't know if it's that way now, but at the time, we're talking about the 50s and 60s after World War II, if you were the children of you know, the soldiers who had fought in World War II, that age bracket, baby boomer age, although in the UK, you had two options. You could either join the manual labor force, which would be working in the factories over there, or the construction business, which Bond's family had, or if you really wanted to be a musician, you had a lot of music clubs. But there's almost like an angst and an industrial sound to how the music was approached through all the bands that you had named. And I think John's style of playing, I don't know if Zeppelin itself would be described the same way, but his style of drumming has that big, heavy, almost industrial sound, which is like the sound of his drums is his way of articulating, I think, those types of feelings.
Tell us the story now of how John got spotted by Jimmy Page and got in the band. Give me the genesis of that.
I'd love to. John had been in... he had been friends with Robert Plant for a number of years already. They were buddies. They were from similar areas, and they were not childhood friends, but they were older teenagers when they started to hang out. And they were in a number of separate bands, and then they were in, and they had jammed together with different groups. And they eventually, the funny thing that's, anybody that played with would either disband or you would stop getting gigs in some capacity. He was so loud, the way, you know, clubs couldn't handle his sound. So that's one of the reasons that he kind of really padded to different bands. It wasn't necessarily his fault. It was just the sound of his drums. Both he and Plant stayed in touch. They were buddies, but they ended up performing in multiple different bands. They went their separate ways. Plant was scouted by Jimmy Page first. Page had gotten, he had, it is a long story that some people, most people do know how he had kind of risen in the ranks to ownership of the new, of the Yardbirds, and wanted to have the new Yardbirds. That would be the new band. They already had a tour for Scandinavia booked, and the rest of the members of the Yardbirds had already left. So it was just Page. He had to fill in every other member of the band. So he got to create the band he wanted.
Our first tour together, actually, with the band was in Scandinavia. In fact, it acted as a warm-up tour to the British clubs. But, curiously enough, that was an old commitment that the Yardbirds had to fulfill. And so we called ourselves the New Yardbirds for that. After that, it was Led Zeppelin.
When he got Robert Plant as his singer, and the last piece of the puzzle that they needed was a drummer, and they wanted someone who had some of the versatility of, say, Ginger Baker or Mitch Mitchell. And as soon as Page and Plant started to discuss their joint love of blues and the versatility of what they would be able to do in the studio, Plant's thoughts immediately was, I have a friend that you have to see. There's the one person who is going for the heavy sound that you want, and that we, you know, that you would be able to get in the vision of what you're looking for with the new Yardbirds. So it was Plant who knew that John was playing with Tim Rose on tour, and took Page and Peter Grant to that gig in order to see him play. And they immediately after the show started to discuss how to take him from Tim Rose's touring band. We want him. But that's how it was. It was Plant who did it.
Okay, now let me ask you a question, because I when I was researching my book, and Anita and I just got done talking to the author of a Yardbirds book.
Yeah, so that's awesome.
Chris Drea. You didn't speak to him, did you?
No, but he's mentioned very prominently within the book. He's given interviews about working with John.
Okay, because I believe him.
No, I want to hear this.
He went with Peter Grant and Jimmy Page because he was technically still the bass player. He hadn't quit yet completely, and John Paul Jones hadn't been hired yet.
Right.
So the three of them went to scout John Bonham and Robert Plant. And according to Chris, Jimmy was all set on Bonham. Bonham, absolutely a must-have, this guy.
Mm-hmm.
But he thought that Robert Plant, I'm not too sure.
Well, when the Yardbirds kind of burnt out from intensive touring back in the late 60s, I'd already decided I want to follow my other passion, which was photography. So I had that all lined up and I came to New York, etc. But I was very, very friendly with both Peter and Jimmy. So on a couple of occasions, I accompanied them on to see guys that Jimmy may have wanted or not wanted to go into the band he was forming. I remember going up to somewhere outside of Birmingham and seeing the amazing John Bonham, who was linked to, of course, Robert Plant. And on the way back, you know, John Bonham was an absolute must-have. Little iffy about Robert. He did eventually make it, very well, in fact. But that was an interesting moment.
There's a couple of people that have said that, where even after the first their legendary first jam session, where they knew that there was just this alchemy of sound, from what different people have said over the years behind closed doors, Jimmy and Peter, they stayed on the fence about Robert Plant's participation for that first tour. It was undecided if he was going to be the member that was going to last. Because if you go back, as I said, the original reviews, if you look at them, now it is actually laughable, because Plant arguably has had the most successful solo career. And he's worked in multiple genres. He's one of my favorite vocalists. But his vocal style, got a lot of criticism during Zeppelin's earliest gigs. If you look at the reviews, it's fascinating that critics didn't necessarily get his octave range and his overall visual look and the androgyny of it, which became a thing for so many artists. But there was talk early on that Plant, if any member was going to not be there anymore, it was going to be Robert. Well, when it comes to Bonham, there's jokes about, even in Birmingham, he one of his side gigs as a kid, he'd work for his father, then he'd get fired by his father, and then get rehired, and then, as the boss's son. But one of the jobs that he did have when he was about 17, 18 years old is he worked at a fine suit store in Birmingham, actually for a tailor. It's tough to imagine that, but he did. And he got discounts on suits, and he would dress up in his own style, especially when he would see the drummers that he loved on television starting to show the progressive style of the late 60s, the mod style starting to evolve into hippie culture. Again, Ginger Baker and especially Mitch Mitchell.
Keith Moon.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Keith Moon, a
major,
huge one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. These guys were trendsetters.
Especially Robert Plant and Jimmy Page. They had so many girlfriends. They had girlfriends who became famous just because mm-hmm. they were their girlfriends at the time.
Sure.
And of course, the Kate Hudson character is based in almost
Penny
famous.
Lane. Yeah.
It's based on a couple of his girlfriends and the whole. But John Bonham, his love affair with Patricia, with Pat, yeah. his wife, was just one of those amazing things where he literally could not go on without her. That was basically, I think, why he had so many problems on the road. He was just mm-hmm. he would drink too much. He was so unhappy.
I'll be honest, I'm really glad that you brought that up, because this was one of the early concerns that I would have, because I try and be as objective as possible and I don't like to omit material when it's very important. I was actually very, very pleasantly surprised that John Bonham's activities on the road didn't include anything that was really outside of his marriage. If you get to the core of it, he was known as the hotel room destroyer. All right, yes, very heavy drinker, which was something that goes back to his childhood friendships with people. That was a cultural thing. But his love of Pat, I think, was one of the driving forces of why he wanted to be successful. It was love at first sight with the two of them. They had a very happy marriage. And it's Jason and Zoe's mother. And she was really good for him. She was home to him from everything. That's what it points to. He wanted to offer her stability, which is why it came down to whether he would even stick with drumming. He had promised her he wouldn't unless he'd get a stable gig or take up his father's offer to take over the construction business. John's behavior on the road, and I was told this by a number of people that were there, it was a certain amount of discontent from being away from his family and the familiar surroundings for so long. He was kind of a wreck without Pat for such long periods of time. I liked knowing that about him. It felt better to write about someone where you could relate to those, not necessarily superhuman on stage qualities, but the human qualities about it. And that was probably one of the most beautiful things about him that I had heard, his loyalty to her.
Which behind the scenes people did you get a chance to talk with?
The most enjoyable interviews that I had gotten with anyone affiliated with Swan Song, there were two that I really enjoyed a lot, and I have to give a shout out because they're just great guys. Danny Goldberg, who is a very, very legendary music manager for decades at this point, because Danny, when he was in his 20s, he had worked PR for Swan Song I'm sorry, before it was known as Swan Song, but he was then scouted to be the vice president by Peter Grant, who he still refers to as his mentor. Danny is an awesome person and was helpful in major ways with both books that I've done, and he had great stories about being on the road with Zeppelin. And thanks to him, I was able to get Neil Preston, their official photographer, who had great stories of being on the road, 1975 in particular, being with the band. Those were two big, longer interviews that were part of the book.
So you know about Danny's famous, bigger than the Beatles comments?
That was the newspaper headline, as I recall, right?
Well, the first two shows of the 1973 Led Zeppelin tour were outdoor stadiums. Most of the shows were in arenas, but the first two were in stadiums. First one was at Atlanta Stadium, and the second one was Tampa Stadium. Tampa had a paid capacity of 56,800, which was slightly more than what Shea Stadium had sold when the Beatles had played there some years earlier. So I invented the idea that this had broken the Beatles' record for the best show by an artist. And, of course, the Beatles, if Shea Stadium had held more seats, they could have sold more tickets. It wasn't that Led Zeppelin was actually more popular in 1973 than the Beatles had been in 1965, but it so happened that Tampa Stadium held about 1,000 more seats. So, because I knew the critics were not going to say the music was great. Not then, not in 1973. And so that became kind of the big selling point, was bigger than the Beatles. And in fact, when I saw the Led Zeppelin reunion show in London, they showed a little videotape, which I guess is included on the DVD re-release of Song Remains the Same, from a Tampa TV station where the guy was kind of reading the talking points from my press release, but bigger than the Beatles, you know. So I felt this corny gimmick must have appealed to the band, since they were still using it 30-some years later.
Danny tells a story better, obviously, than anybody, but he also has an awesome sense of humor and a great memory, which is perfect for someone affiliated with rock history. But what I enjoyed also is when Peter Grant had told Danny, when Zeppelin played in Atlanta, sold out, packed house, someone needs to say that, you know, this is the biggest thing since Gone with the Wind. You know, the biggest thing in Atlanta since Gone with the Wind. And he asked Peter Grant, do you want me to say that you said that? No, someone has to say that. So Danny had to attribute the Peter Grant's quote to someone and got permission from the mayor of Atlanta that he could attribute it to him. It shows how grandiose the power was with Zeppelin's hold over how they ran the media. But at the same time, I liked that there was such loyalty in how the strategy worked between Grant and his musicians. Danny was able to fill in a lot of gaps in trying to understand Grant's love of Page and what he saw in him when he was representing him.
Okay, so let me ask you, obviously you talked to a lot of other musicians, and we do that too.
Yeah.
I think just about every drummer we have on, we ask him about Bonham. So, tell me who you've spoken to, because one of the people we talked to, and you're going to hear from them, is talking about Bonham and Zeppelin in general. One of the that comes to mind was Roger Earle, who's still today in Foghat, and yeah, was in Savoy Brown, which was a contemporary of Led Zeppelin, part of that whole blues, you know, Savoy Brown, Fleetwood Mac,
they were fans.
Zeppelin, that whole thing.
Zeppelin went to go see some of their gigs when they were on tour, when they'd be in the same cities. Absolutely. They were big fans of their work.
Roger says that, I mean, Zeppelin was just awesome, and Bonham was awesome.
Now, Led Zeppelin were very much their own band. Jimmy's playing was incredible, his rhythm playing, the riffs that he came up with. Robert Plant was a great singer and a unique singer. John Paul Jones is probably one of the greatest bass players ever. And I don't think I could ever say enough about how John Bonham played and like what he did to rock and roll music. All of them were great musicians. Yeah, they were totally unique. They had a whole different approach. They had a whole different attitude and power to playing that other bands at that era didn't even think about. Their music and their interpretation of other people's songs was like unique and gave them gave them a huge place in rock and roll history.
It's cool talking with drummers who put Bonham on that shelf because they're able to break down what it is about their playing that affected them the most. The drummer who I had probably the most fun speaking with, because I've been a fan for years, but their paths only crossed one time. They weren't necessarily contemporaries because it's Stuart Copeland. The Police were up and coming in the late 70s, and Bonham, for all the competitive edge that he had when it came to his contemporaries, you know, musicians had that, you know, this playful competition. Bonham was actually really kind to younger musicians and was a big advocate for the up and coming bands that were, you know, following in their footsteps. He loved the Police. He took Jason and he took his sister Deborah to go see a Police gig when they were in Birmingham, and told Stuart Copeland, who was, I think, 19, 20 years old at the time, "You're the guys that are going to knock us off the charts," which is a huge thing for a young musician to hear. But Stuart Copeland was one of my favorite interviews that I got to do, because he not only told me what he loved about John's style, but also how it deviates from what his influences were. John's influences, meaning jazz and breaking it down.
Led Zeppelin had a love-hate relationship with the press. You want to address that? I think the only press person that they had a good relationship with was Chris Welch, who was the editor of Melody Maker. And in fact, he went on a number of gigs. The band would bring him on tour when they played Carnegie Hall.
He was
telling me how Bonham just went nuts because he knew that Gene Krupa had played there.
My first ever trip to America was with Led Zeppelin. But the concert I was going to see was actually Led Zeppelin at Carnegie Hall, New York City, in October 1969. And that was a very historic event, very exciting for everybody concerned, really. The audience reaction really surprised me, because back in England in those days, English fans were quite subdued or reserved, as you might expect. They wouldn't be screaming and shouting and hooting and jumping on the stage and shaking hands with the artists, which is what happened at Carnegie Hall. I remember John Bonham saying that he wanted to be really good that night, because that was where Gene Krupa used to play, the famous jazz drummer, used to play at Carnegie Hall. And he remembered all those records, and he wanted to be on good form. So he played incredibly well that night.
That tells you a lot, I think, that he was still so starstruck being in this arena where one of his own heroes had played. Yeah, Zeppelin did have a love-hate relationship with the press, and I think it's because it's difficult. This is what's interesting. They, especially in the early years, they did not get the most favorable press. There were some scathing, not across the board, they got a lot of good write-ups, but there were some negative comments about their heavy approach, in particular how they utilized a lot of blues music without the proper citations. But they got called on it. Rolling Stone was not happy when they noticed that Zeppelin was doing that. They were criticizing every aspect of Zeppelin's visuals, you know how their performance on stage. Then when word would get around to their behavior within the hotels, how much money they were getting for each gig, Peter Grant's very, very strong tactics in securing the money for each one of these gigs, his, you know, these relationships with the promoters. If you add all of that up, there was negative press at the beginning. Zeppelin, they were kids. You wouldn't think of them this way, but they were sensitive at the time. And Jimmy was, you know, as a session player and as a member of the Yardbirds, he had traveled more than any of them. And he kind of, I think, knew that was probably coming, and so did Peter Grant. And the solution was to kind of get as much control over the media as possible and to be as closed off as they could be to unsolicited reviews, photography, and things like that. And I have to say this, if it's okay, it still happens. This is the first album it surpassed its 50-year anniversary of Zeppelin One. I'm doing, I did a book on John Bonham. I'm generationally removed from when these guys were still touring, still putting out albums.
You mentioned Richard Cole, who's the legendary road manager for Led Zeppelin, and also the inspiration for Hammer of the Gods.
And I will say this, one of the things that I did, and I do want to make this clear, because I tried to get as many people from Zeppelin as possible. I didn't think I'd be able to get the original band members because they still have mandates about talking to the press. And they also had their 50th anniversary book coming out, which Jimmy Page had said, this is the official, you know, like he put out the Led Zeppelin Grimoire, which is supposed to be, you know, this is the dogma of the story of the band. So they wouldn't have to talk with press anymore. I think that was one of the reasons. But what I did do is I tried to contact and interview as many of their biographers as possible. For example, if I may list that, Chris Alwitz is one of my favorite music journalists. And he did this incredible definitive book on Joe Strummer years ago. And then in 2019, did this big, beautiful, thick biography, what is billed as the definitive biography of Jimmy Page. The reason I bring this up is because Mark Blake, I have been a fan of Mark Blake as a music writer since I'm in high school. And just a few years ago, he did the authorized biography of Peter Grant. And he worked with Grant's son, Warren Grant, in order to put that out. Speaking with them and filling in the context of the relationships, I tried to put into context their relationships with each other, with the press, and also kind of demystify some of the things that Cole had said publicly in books like his own and Hammer of the Gods. Because as you remember, a lot of the legendary type stories about Zeppelin and their behavior on the road stems from Hammer of the Gods, 1985, and
one thing I remember about Richard Cole, because I did have a chance to speak with him, and he had worked for Vanilla Fudge before Zeppelin, and he'd worked for Peter Grant for a while, so he had seen just about everybody. Even he was blown away by John Bonham and couldn't believe that they found this guy.
The tour was paid for, underwritten by Jimmy Page, Peter Grant, and John Paul Jones. The other two, Bonham and Plant, were on salaries. There was five shows with the Vanilla Fudge. It was actually in the one in Oregon where I really realized, during the drum solo. And I was standing there with Jonesy, and I just said to Jesus Christ, where did you find this guy?
Yeah, that's they actually connected, I think Bonham and Cole also connected because they were, I think Richard Cole also was a drummer, even as a hobbyist drummer, which is not to downplay his musical abilities, but when he was a kid, I know that he had played the drums and connected with John, and they had some of the same favorites, a lot of the jazz guys that we had listed, Krupa and Buddy Rich, and they got along very, very well.
Now, the fact that, let me just go back a minute, the fact that sure. Bonham, that Jimmy Page chose Bonham
to
be the drummer, was sort of in keeping with, it's actually Jerry Wexler who signed the band to Atlantic.
Atlantic, yeah.
He had a thing that he lived by, and that was only sign musicians who are virtuoso musicians, because all they want to do is play with other musicians of, of that caliber.
Yeah.
And so he spotted Bonham as being the greatest. So when Wexler said to, you know, signed Zeppelin, he knew that everybody else in the band was going to be great, and he thought there was almost no risk. Phil Carson, who was an executive up at Atlantic Records, told me the Jerry Wexler story.
Jerry was very aware of what was happening in England, and he became very cognizant of the great players that there were in England. And one of the players he knew about was Jimmy Page. And he heard that Jimmy Page was putting a group together which was going to be called the New Yardbirds, and he got on the case immediately. He wanted to have the group that Jimmy Page was in. Jerry had an A&R philosophy, which is how I kind of lived my life by his philosophy after he taught it to me, which was that you should never sign a band unless there's a virtuoso musician in it. And he wanted this group called the New Yardbirds because he knew there was a virtuoso musician. His philosophy came from the fact that he felt that a virtuoso musician doesn't play with good musicians, he only plays with great musicians. So if you can find a group that's got a virtuoso in it, rush after it, because they're going to be surrounded by other great people. I believe that he signed the new Yardbirds, which of course later became Led Zeppelin, before he heard a note of music. I think he had the meeting with Peter Grant, the manager of the new Yardbirds as it initially was, and Steve Weiss, the attorney, and I think he made that deal without hearing anything that the group were going to play, because that's how much he believed in Jimmy Page.
Think of all the artists that were on Atlantic at the time. The idea that Zeppelin was signed.
Well, Zion Butterfly, Vanilla Fudge, they were the cream. They were, you know, that was ATCO, but it was part of Atlantic. But I believe, and you can tell me if I'm correct on this, that Zeppelin had it in their contract that they wanted had to be on Atlantic because
you
they
are
were
correct.
Such huge fans of Ray Charles and all the early stuff, and they wouldn't.
Aretha, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they weren't going for the ATCO.
Nope, it was the prestige. It made them a premier band. It was contractual. Denny's correct. Yeah, it was a negotiating tactic that Jimmy had mandated, and Peter Grant made sure that he was able to deliver it.
Wow. There's so many great stories in the book. The Peter Grant, Bill Graham showdown. There's just so many. We should mention the name of the book is called The Beast.
And mention who our guest is.
Yes, C.M. Cushions. You know, your book is coming out in September, correct?
September 7th, yeah. It's coming out.
But now you can do a pre-sale, right? You can do pre-order for this book?
It is up for pre-order right now. And now I'm having so much fun just talking Zeppelin with you guys. I should put this in there at least. Yeah, it comes out September 7th in hardcover. Hachette is my publisher, and it is up for pre-order now. And I think the biggest thank you that I have to give really, really quickly is that I am very happy to report that the foreword for the book, Beast, is one of my personal heroes and the biggest drummer of my generation, who is much more than that now. Dave Grohl did contribute the foreword to the book. He is just a spectacular multi-instrumentalist anyway. But when I was growing up, it was Nirvana first. He was my favorite drummer when I was a kid, and now Foo Fighters, biggest band in the world. And he did. He made the time to read the book and to contribute the foreword. So I'm incredibly grateful to him. And I can't wait until people get to read the foreword that he wrote, because no, it is not available just yet, but he wrote something very beautiful for Bonham at the beginning. So very excited to share that too.
So tell us some of the other revelations, things that you found out that maybe the average person might not know. I mean, the hardcore Zeppelin fan might.
But as far as revelations are concerned, hardcore Zeppelin fans will recognize a lot of the tidbits of information in the minutiae, and I understand that. But I think I do try and write for a general audience where Zeppelin fans will enjoy it. Bonham fans will be, you know, I think will love having his full story in one place at one time and have the new details interspersed throughout it, plus about his kits, his cars, and the anecdotes. It's the story of Zeppelin, but it's also John's story all in one with their trajectory, their career. You know, the name of the book is Beast, but that's not just, you know, for bad behavior. I meant the beast of his sound, the beast of the music industry itself. It's supposed to mean a few things. Plus, it's, you know, Moby Dick is his famous solo, and, you know, it's a tip of the hat to Melville. So there's a few different reasons for that. What the revelations were to me is that he was a much more disciplined musician than you would ever realize from the lurid tales of being on the road that people associate with him. Bonham was the first person to show up at soundcheck. He was the first musician that was there to hear how his drums were going to sound before anybody else got to the stage. That was fascinating to me. The idea that he actually tuned his kit for you know, how the sound was going to play in different arenas, in you know, in different studios. He really was a musician's musician, and that goes back to his youth. He had great pitch, great sound, and great hearing, which I think made him what would have made him an incredible jazz player if he played in a different genre. Learning about his musicianship and how serious he was with his craft, and that he was always listening to new drummers to see what was out there, all that was fascinating to me. And hearing about what a wonderful dad and husband he was, to hear the human side of it. The biggest revelation to me is when you hear about the human side of the superhuman rock icon. There are a lot more warmer stories about him and why his loyalty to his friends and family has kept people still very protective of his memory. When I hear the happy stuff, to me, that's the best part. But I will say this, the main thesis of the book itself, and this is what really, you had asked me at the very beginning, Denny, why I wanted to write about Bonham at all. I am a musician. I'm a keyboardist. I play jazz and blues piano, but I played, in rock bands also. And as a jazz fan, I loved the idea. When I had heard, friends told me that Bonham was a huge jazz guy, and I'm a huge jazz fan myself, how the idea of his playing technique, you know, played heavy, but with jazz influence in a different context and with Jimmy Page's brilliance as a producer, how if you add that together, you all of a sudden have this really cool but obscure branch of lineage, not just of blues, but of jazz technique into what would become heavy metal. The missing piece of the puzzle where you get jazz musicianship and what would become, you know, heavy rock and heavy metal.
Yeah, I think the only other person in that category is Anita's favorite, Ginger Baker.
Oh, there you go.
I have to say, the things he did, I mean, because I'm a big Buddy Rich, I didn't know as much about Gene Krupa as I did Buddy Rich, but yeah, but now I have a whole new appreciation for John Bonham.
So two things. First, because a little bit ago we were talking about the final tour, the 1980 tour.
Yeah.
I mean, the only thing that we know is because we had Simon Kirk on, and Simon was guested with John Bonham on the date before the final date on that tour.
Oh, that's awesome.
And he tells us the whole story about rehearsing in John's room on his bed. And you know, it was just unbelievable. Then, of course, when he died, I mean, Simon went nuts.
Well, Bonzo was the best hard rock drummer ever, hands down. I mean, no one comes within a mile of him. He kept great time. He was fearless. He'd do things that you think, you know, how is he going to do this? He was the best.
CM, let me just thank you for coming by and giving us an exclusive. I think this is great, talking about a new book on John Bonham before anybody else knows about it. And we wish you a lot of luck with it. The book is called Beast, John Bonham and the Rise of Led Zeppelin. CM Cushions, goes by the name of Chad, has been our guest. And we wish you a lot of luck with the book. And maybe, you know, you can come back sometime after the book's out.
If I may, Denny and Anita, I'm so honored to have been on the podcast. I love what you guys have been doing. I love that there's a real rock and roll podcast that's out there. I love the guests that you have. And it really is an honor to be able to talk about the book for the first time with both of you. So please know how grateful I am. Can't wait to come back.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so please keep in touch. Go to our website, therockpodcast.com. We're on Instagram. We're on Facebook. You can send us an email at hello@therockpodcast.com. Until next time.